The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or printing impaired. Hi everybody, this is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with an article from the August 20, 2024 online edition of the New Yorker, Open Questions. Should we think of our children as strangers? A new line of inquiry asks us to imagine them as random individuals who just happen to live in our homes. By Joshua Rothman. Being a parent raises so many urgent, concrete questions. Will this movie cause nightmares? Is this enough sunscreen? Where are the Cheez-Its? That the abstract ones often slip beneath the surface, only to emerge later. Unbidden. In the morning, making breakfast, you can look up from the waffle mix to see your kids and think, wait, did I make these people? On lifeguard duty, you can feel suddenly watched by an imaginary adult version of the child in the pool and wonder, how much of that grown-up already exists, and how much has yet to arrive? Parents know their children with astonishing intimate specificity. And yet each child is also an unknown, a whole and separate individual living an independent life in your house. This duality contributes to both the challenge and the thrill of raising children. The fact that children are their own people can come as a surprise to parents. This is partly because young kids are so hopelessly dependent. But it also reflects how we think about parenthood. Before we have children, we often ask ourselves if we want them. We mull whether having them will make us happier or more mature or bring meaning to our lives or in some sense fulfill our destinies. We talk as though having children is mainly a matter of inclination, of personal desire, of appetite. The philosopher Mara Vandeleude writes in Begetting, what does it mean to create a child? She sees this as totally backward. Like Dr. Frankenstein, we are neglecting the monster's point of view. What will our possible children think of their existence? Will they be glad they've been born? Or curses for ushering them into being? Having children, Vandeleude argues, might be best seen as a cosmic intervention, something great and wondrous and terrible. We are deciding that life is worth living on behalf of a person who cannot be consulted, and we must be prepared at any point to be held accountable for their creation. From a historical perspective, these may be new concerns. Before contraception, Vandeleude writes, people used to just have children in the course of life, whether they wanted them or not. Back then, it was God who shouldered the moral burden of being the creator. We turned to him, perplexed, to ask why he'd bothered to make us, even though man is born unto trouble as the sparks fly upward. Today, though, we are all creators, and so the theological has become personal. Begetting, accordingly, reacts to a larger movement to reconsider the ethics of procreation. Pronatalists, among them Donald Trump's vice presidential nominee J.D. Vance, urge us to have more kids on practical, moral, and existential grounds. Antinatalists maintain that having children may be morally wrong, perhaps because it increases the total quantity of suffering in the universe. Life is hard, or because it pushes the planet closer to ecological collapse. Vandeleude is not pronatalist, but she isn't antinatalist either. Her contention is simply that we should confront these questions more directly. Typically, she observes, it's people who don't want kids who are asked to explain themselves. Maybe it should work the other way. So that when someone says that they want kids, people ask, why? The problem is that it's hard to say. Van der Lucht inventories the reasons why people have children, ranking them from callow, conformity, boredom, satisfying your parents, to admirable, purpose, companionship, happiness, love. Yet she finds that even the best, most sincere reasons come up short. Life can be full of struggle and is possibly meaningless. Death is inevitable and sometimes painful, and love alone cannot justify all things. As a rule, philosophers are not easily satisfied. Van der Lucht concludes that having kids is such a big deal, especially to the kids, that nothing we can say is really equal to it. And so we might proceed with a sense of trepidatious, hand-wavy gratitude, admitting to ourselves that our future kids could decide that what we're doing is outrageous. Van der Lucht cites the example of a Flemish couple who took parental vows at their city hall. In the presence of witnesses and a local magistrate, they promised their child things such as safety, a proper education, no violence, and to keep the child's interest at heart in the case of conflicts, she reports. Many parents, probably most of them, hope to give such things to their children. But the import of those hopes is different when you express them in public, possibly addressing someone who hasn't even been born yet. It's as though you're humbling yourself before the judgment of the independent person your child will someday become. What about after we have kids? In a 2014 book, Family Values, The Ethics of Parent-Child Relationships, the philosopher Harry Brighouse and the political theorist Adam Swift ask how we might relate to our children, if we understand them, from the beginning of their lives as independent individuals. There's a tension, they write, between the ideals of a liberal society and the widely held proprietarian view of children. The idea that children in some sense belong to their parents continues to influence many who reject the once common view that wives belong to their husbands, they note. But what's the alternative? What would a family look like if the fundamental separateness of children was taken for granted, even during the years when they depend on us the most? Just as Van der Lucht explores the mysteries of begetting by trying to justify it from first principles, so Brighouse and Swift ask, why parents? They entertain a few non-parental ways of raising kids, state-regulated quasi-orphanages in which children are raised by trained and specialized employees, kibbutz-like institutions that combine parents with designated child-raising specialists, and communes in which a large group of adults collectively and jointly raises a group of children, with no one being particularly responsible for anyone else. Although there are theoretical reasons for favoring such arrangements, it's possible to imagine that a state-run quasi-orphanage might treat its charges equally, for example, whereas some families are richer than others. They conclude, after an extensive discussion, that children have a right to be raised by parents. This is because kids have a more general right to a good upbringing, and such an upbringing is best delivered by particular people who interact with them continuously during the course of their development. Steady, attentive caregivers, biological or not, are best suited to deliver familial relationship goods. This is an odd, even torturous way to think about something as familiar as the family. And yet it yields interesting results. If the relationship between parents and children is based not on the proprietary ownership of kids by their parents, but on the right of children to a certain kind of upbringing, then it makes sense to ask what parents must do to satisfy that right, and conversely, what's irrelevant to satisfying it. Brighouse and Swift, after pushing and prodding their ideas in various ways, conclude that their version of the family is a little less dynastic than usual. Some people, for instance, think that parents are entitled to do everything they can to give their children advantages in life. But, as the authors see it, some ways of seeking to advantage your children, from leaving them inheritances to paying for elite schooling, are not part of the bundle of familial relationship goods to which kids have a right. In fact, confusing these transactional acts for those goods, love, presence, moral tutelage, and so on, would be a mistake. This is not to say that parents must not give their kids huge inheritances or send them to private schools, but it is to say that if the government decides to raise the inheritance tax, it is not interfering with some sacred parental right. Similarly, we often think that parents are entitled to pass their values on to their children. Are they? To a great extent, passing on your values is a natural consequence of having an authentic relationship with your kids. But not always. Children have a right to become more autonomous as they grow older, Swift and Brighouse write. They are entitled to the kind of parent-child relationship that encourages them to develop ever greater intellectual and emotional agency. Good parents, therefore, ensure that their children have the cognitive skills and information needed for autonomy, while restraining themselves from adding too much to the emotional costs borne by their children should they decide to reject the parents' views. It's all right to raise your children to be progressive or conservative, religious or secular, athletic or bookish, but it is wrong to make it too hard for them to renounce your way of life. For parents to raise their children successfully, they must establish themselves as loving authorities, the authors write. A loving authority is not an ultimate one. In the epigraph to their book, Brighouse and Swift quote from On Children, a poem by Khalil Gibran. Your children are not your children. They are the sons and daughters of life's longing for itself. They come through you, but not from you. And though they are with you, yet they belong not to you. The basic point is simple, they write. Children are separate people with their own lives to lead and the right to make and act on their own judgments about how they are to live those lives. They are not the property of their parents. But what about nightmares and sunscreen and Cheez-Its? Someone has to be in charge of it all, or at least to try to be. Books like Begetting and Family Values can seem, at times, cartoonish. The philosophical equivalent of my son protesting, "You're not the boss of me!" Yet they actually trace a subtle line, identifying an insoluble balancing act. Clearly, there are parents who actually feel that their kids are extensions of themselves. They can be seen on the sidelines at soccer games, gnashing their teeth and pulling their hair. Even the most well-adjusted parenting, however, contains an element of self-defeat. To be a good parent, arguably, to be even become a parent, you need to exercise your power. But that power is always slipping through your fingers, undermined by the unpredictability of life, your children's resistance and liveliness, and the passage of time. Gibran's poem can read like advice, but it might not be. It could just be an articulation of something parents are always coming to know. A person's life can never be fully explained, justified, or contained. Not your child's and not your own. Next, from the Elements Department of the August 14, 2024 online edition of The New Yorker, the veterinarians preventing the next pandemic. Most new diseases have their origins in animals. So why aren't we paying more attention to their health? By Rivka Galkin. In the summer of 1999, a pathologist at the Bronx Zoo noticed an unusual number of dead crows in the vicinity of the zoo. Then, over Labor Day weekend, one of the zoo's cormorants died, as did a pheasant, a bald eagle, and three flamingos. In Queens, physicians at Flushing Hospital saw six patients with encephalitis, all within a few weeks. Normally, the city saw about 10 cases a year, but now similar cases were turning up across the city. The disease presentation suggested a viral cause. But which virus? By the end of September, seven human patients had died, and others had had to be hospitalized for weeks. After the virus was identified as West Nile, a mosquito-borne virus that infects both birds and humans, and which no one expected to see in North America, the dead crow suddenly made sense. I think it was really the West Nile virus that was the impetus for recognizing the value of having veterinarians work in public health departments. Sally Slavinsky, a veterinarian at New York City's Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, told me. Slavinsky focuses on zoonotic diseases, infectious diseases that can move from an animal to a human. Diseases cross over very rarely, with less than a tenth of 1% of animal viruses ever successfully making the leap. And yet, from another perspective, the crossovers are common. More than two-thirds of emerging diseases in humans have animal origins. Diseases can also travel in the other direction, in what is called reverse zoonosis. I'll never forget the call from my colleague at the Bronx Zoo saying they had a tiger testing positive for SARS-CoV-2, Slavinsky said. Her office worked on contact tracing for the big cats. She also does a lot of work with less regal urban friends, such as skunks, bats, and raccoons. They've adapted incredibly well to urban life, she said, which often means dealing with rabies, perhaps the only zoonotic disease so storied as to have its own adjective. Canine rabies was eliminated from the United States in 2004, but the disease persists in other animals. Slavinsky recalled the 2009 outbreak of raccoon rabies in Central Park, in which some 500 raccoons needed to be trapped, vaccinated, and released. Yes, we're disease detectives, Slavinsky said, of the work she does with her colleagues. But not just with humans, across animals and the environment. One example is that of leptospirosis, a potentially deadly bacterial disease not usually seen in humans in New York, which can cause fevers, and in some cases, liver and kidney failure, as well as pulmonary hemorrhage. In 2018, 32 cases were reported in dogs, more than ever before. Veterinarians were advised to discuss the lepto vaccine with their clients. And in 2023, 24 cases were found in humans, more than any previous year. Since many different mammals can carry leptospirosis, often asymptomatically, it wasn't clear where it was originating. Slavinsky's team worked with CDC labs that analyzed the strains of leptospirosis. They spoke with physicians about the exposure histories and clinical presentations of the patients. The disease turned out to be coming from a critter whose control was usually motivated by quality of life concerns rather than infectious disease issues, rats. They are fascinating, resilient creatures that I have so much respect for, Slavinsky said. They're just trying to get by like the rest of us. Chronic wasting disease in deer, hemorrhagic disease in rabbits, canine distemper in foxes, these are all indifferent to city limits. Slavinsky often collaborates with veterinarians in other parts of the state, such as the wildlife veterinarian for New York's Wildlife Health Program. Elizabeth Bunting, who had previously worked at zoos and wildlife clinics, helped create and shape the wildlife veterinarian role in 2010 and held it until last year. When Bunting began, almost no state in the Northeast had such a job. Most still don't. Wildlife had a management bent and a conservation bent, Bunting explained. Biologists in local offices contributed to decisions about things like how many deer could be hunted each year or how to protect rare salamanders. But few were looking at disease, really, she said. The thinking was that it was natural for a disease to run through wildlife and therefore it was not a concern. A paper that was published in Nature around that time detailed how many diseases crossing over into humans were coming from wildlife populations, and New York State was a global hotspot for such introductions. As the new wildlife veterinarian, Bunting worked alongside the also newly hired wildlife disease ecologist, Christian Schuller, and the two brought up the paper in their presentations to people working in the Department of Environmental Conservation and other state agencies with whom they would need to collaborate. I think at first they saw me as this tree hugger who was going to send out crutches to the baby squirrel that fell from the tree, she said. So we visited every office. We had barbecues. We brought donuts, she said. Listening to their needs informed the development of the Wildlife Health Program. They centralized data on disease reports in wildlife, making it possible for one county or agency to know what another county or agency was seeing. They developed training workshops on the detection and management of diseases. They created mathematical tools for analyzing and predicting how diseases in wildlife were spreading and for what the impacts were likely to be. We don't need to know about every woodchuck hit by a car, but we want to identify things that have the potential to cross to people or to farm animals or that will affect wildlife populations overall, Bunting said. Trying to predict which diseases will become significant threats is a bit like counting cards. You can know a lot, the gene sequence of a virus, what mutations make it easier for it to jump, where it's coming from, yet it's still uncertain how you should place your bet and what the next card in the deck will be. Avian influenza will be tough, Bunting said. HPAI. Highly pathogenic avian influenza has been around for decades. It can be present in wild birds, and sometimes it crosses over to poultry farms. Since 2022, it has been resurgent in the U.S. Typically, the approach to containing HPAI has been to kill all the likely infected poultry. Cases in wild birds aren't similarly containable. In a 2014 outbreak, the virus began out west, with wild birds infecting poultry. The virus then arrived at turkey farms in the Midwest. Ultimately, more than 50 million birds were killed. But we didn't have any human infections, Bunting said, and the virus was eventually contained. These days, biosecurity for workers on many major chicken farms, Tyvek suits, booties, tracking, shower in, shower out, resembles the world of Mission Impossible. Since the most recent HPAI outbreak was detected, more than 100 million birds infected or suspected of being infected have been killed. During the outbreak, Bunting got calls from one of New York's wildlife hospitals about foxes that turned up with neurological symptoms. They proved to be the result of HPAI. Did that mean dogs were also at risk? Should duck hunters and bird rehabilitators be taking special precautions? You do the surveillance, you do genomic sequence analysis to pick up mutations. That's the job, Bunting said. I really felt for Fauci during COVID because he had to try to make rational decisions with really limited information. Since summer began, I've been reading most nights from the many memoirs of James Herriot, who worked as a rural veterinarian in Yorkshire from the 1940s until several years before his death at age 78 in 1995. He recounts stories of setting out in the middle of the night to tend to difficult calvings for farmers who could only sometimes pay him, of a chatty, cricket-loving client whose pig herd came down with foot-and-mouth disease, which Harriet worried he'd transmitted to a dairy farm, of the fevers and manic cycles he suffered when he developed brucellosis after years of exposure to infected cows, and of a mysteriously ill cat, excessively sleepy with a very faint pulse, that turned out to have been lapping up the splashes of heroin syrup his owner had been prescribed for pain from a cancer he hadn't told Harriet about. Harriet's stories are inherently charming. He said that one of the main authors he studied in order to learn how to write was P.G. Wodehouse. But what keeps his stories compelling across so many volumes is the detailing of his local ecosystem of horses and sheep and humans and pets and farmland and microscopic agents of disease, all bound together in illness and wellness. Since the stories were written in retrospect, he started writing when he was 50, they also illuminate the evolution of ideas about medicine across time. We learn about the shifts in folk treatments, the arrival of antibiotics, the attitude toward women in veterinary medicine, the changes in how animals are housed, the drinking habits of Yorkshire vets. The ecosystem of Los Angeles, from a veterinary public health perspective, is not as different from the Yorkshire countryside as you might think. Los Angeles County was once the major dairy hub west of the Mississippi. A single commercial dairy farm remains in operation today. Karen Enhart, who worked for 24 years as a veterinarian in public health for Los Angeles County, she retired on July 31st, had thought in veterinary school that she was going to be a dairy veterinarian. Her first love was sheep and goats, and in training she also dabbled in cows. She spent a summer working in the Central Valley, where the temperature sometimes reached 110 degrees, checking dairy cows for pregnancy. "I don't know if you know enough about how that's done," she said. I told her that I did, not only because I had been reading Harriet. Not too long ago, most pregnancy checks were done by inserting an arm into the cow's rectum in order to palpate the uterus. When a job in public health came up, Enhart, who loves both animals and statistics, decided to apply. She found it even more interesting than working at dairies, and probably a little safer, too, since you don't get kicked by cows, she said. For a time, she worked in Monterey County, a more rural area, as a public health epidemiologist, before moving to Los Angeles County as a veterinarian in the Department of Public Health. Enhart really got to know the city by doing surveillance for West Nile virus in 2002. She grew up mostly in Northern California with horses, cats, rabbits, and lizards, and also her parents. Angelinos would call in with reports of dead birds, mostly corvids, and she would drive out to pick them up, sometimes in Malibu, sometimes in poor neighborhoods where people were surprised that she turned up at all. "I remember picking up 38 dead birds in one day," Enhart said. "This was before we had Google Maps on our phones. I had a Thomas guide, if you know what that is." Some scientists had thought that it would take many years for the West Nile virus, first seen in New York City, to make it out west. But when it had begun to move west, Enhart instituted a surveillance system to test the local bird population. Finches, sparrows, crows, hawks, and owls. So when the dead bird calls began, Enhart and her team were ready. They had the tests, they had the connections with the labs, they could inform worried citizens about possible exposure to the virus, and also map where the virus was turning up in birds, so as to focus prevention on areas of greatest risk. The West Nile surveillance program was discontinued in 2020 when many staff members were reassigned to COVID. But the systems and partnerships remained in place, making it simple to start up testing for HPAI. Some cases were found in wild birds in LA in 2022 and 2023, but there has only been one case to date this year. Concern rose this year when HPAI was found in dairy cattle in 13 states. HPAI had never before been seen in cattle in the U.S. A handful of dairy workers have tested positive, with conjunctivitis and cough being the most common symptoms. But, so far, there is no indication that HPAI has developed the ability to go from human to human, and the level of risk from HPAI for humans remains low. Which isn't to say there isn't worry. This strain has been harder to contain. It has crossed over into more mammals, including barn cats on dairy farms, and it has been more lethal in raptors. An LA public health official's relationship to the region's dairy farmers is different from how it was in the past. In the 1920s, when the county became the site of America's last outbreaks of foot and mouth disease, they set up quarantines, Erner told me. More than 400 quarantine guards were hired, and one of them shot a Long Beach oil worker when he walked through a restricted area. A pneumonic plague outbreak occurred around the same time, and laws were passed that made all infectious diseases in animals reportable. We dusted those laws off when I got here, Inert said. That animal health and human health and environmental health are continuous, that the damage we cause comes back for us, is commonplace, but it doesn't commonly structure our policies. Herd health, flock health, that is something we think about all the time. That is part of our training, Slavinsky said, of veterinarians and the perspective they bring to public health. She said that she likes the term One Health, which is used by a number of different environmental and health organizations as a way of thinking about the interconnectedness of humans, animals, and the planet, all the more so now with climate change and biodiversity loss. It's such a valuable means for conveying a very complex concept, she said. I think in my world, in my role, it's human-centric, in that it's like, what do we see in animals, in the environment, that we're worried about then spilling over into humans? But it's so important to know and value what's happening in the animal and the environmental world. And now, the weekend essay from the August 17, 2024 online edition of The New Yorker. The trouble with friends, the wonder and the curse of friendship is choice. By Wakey Wang. On a daily basis, I teach kids. By kids, I mean teens to college age, sometimes mid-20s. When I started teaching, I was still a kid myself, so I was careful to refer to my students as students. But now I feel a distinct gap. Kids talk a lot about their friends. For any length of time that you allow them, they will bring up this friend and that friend and a birthday party they went to, a concert, a sleepover, a study sesh, another party, the mall, a Starbucks run, the movies, a two-week trip across Asia which they're planning to take or have taken with friends. Kids don't usually talk about their families. Sometimes I'm taken completely by surprise when, months into our knowing each other, a student mentions having a twin. I suppose hearing the constant chatter about friends has made me consider my own and how hard it can be to maintain these bonds as an adult. Mostly, what I notice is attrition. I lose more friends than I make. An obvious reason for that attrition is marriage. Friends get married and their spouses become their closest friends. My husband is now the person I spend the most time with, face-to-face and over text. I tell him everything and anything because I'm a chronic oversharer and I trust him with my thoughts, however stupid they may be. I used to be the same way with friends. But more and more, I check myself. My 10-second rule, write the text, but wait 10 seconds before sending it. Evaluate whether it's truly vital to pass on this piece of information. When I tell friends something now, I must accept the possibility that they will tell their spouses, with whom I'm friendly, but not friends. A friendship is truly strained when you don't like the spouse. Here is my person, your friend proclaims, flag in the sand, and you must tread carefully. Sometimes this new person is so far removed from what you imagined for your friend that you wonder if you knew your friend at all. After marriage, any walls that already existed between two friends invariably thicken. A friend who used to discuss things with you simply to work through them stops doing so and updates you only on definitive good news, never the bad, the ugly, or the in progress. All of that, you suspect, she saves for her partner. In other words, you're no longer included in the problem solving. Of course, some matters belong first to the marriage, the stuff of intimacy, finance, family, to have or not have children, to want children but not be able to have them. Increasingly, my friends leave me out of these big conversations, and vice versa. But when an outcome is certain or a plan set, we do update one another, which reminds us that we're still, in fact, friends, but also boils the friendship down to a PowerPoint. If I don't have kids, I will lose more friends. This is not a hypothesis. It has already started to happen. Friends, during pregnancy, assure you that nothing will change. You contribute to the diaper fund, attend the baby shower, and once the child arrives, you try to see them. Plan for dinner at 2 p.m. between nap times, but somehow something always comes up. Next time. Yeah, next time. Let's hang out soon. Yeah, soon. But no one proposes a new time, and months go by. Years. You never see them again. You never meet the child. And that begs the question of how close you really were. You consider the possibilities. Perhaps you said or did something irrevocably wrong. To avoid ever saying anything about a child that could be misconstrued, I overcompensate. I never bring up the child or ask after it. Or if I do, I make the mistake I just made and refer to the child as an it. A likely scenario is that my friends, as new parents, went down their friend list and crossed people out. Having friends without kids is harder for them to justify. What is our baby going to do at their non-baby-proof place? And remember that time they referred to our child as an it? An it! But I could be overthinking. Doing what writers do, adding nuances to interactions that aren't there. A simpler reality is that my former friends just don't have time for me. Parenting is hard enough without their having to worry about my feelings. I do greatly appreciate the rare friends who stay with me after kids. We meet, as we used to, at restaurants, bars, shows, or when childcare gets hard to schedule, we meet at their apartment. The office, now a nursery, now a toddler's room, now a girl's room, and throughout dinner, the girls, twins, who are supposed to be in bed, come out one at a time, sometimes together, to tell us that they would like to be read to. They would like to drink an entire glass of water. They would like to go to the bathroom. They would like new pajamas. They would like chicken nuggets. They would like to have their hair combed. They would like a specific teddy. They would like a hug, a better hug. They would like to see a rainbow. They would like to go to the bathroom again. They would like more water. They would like to know if it's tomorrow. For the short duration of an evening, I greatly appreciate being part of this. There's a Grace Paley story that I think of when I think about how friendships end. A woman named Cassie asks her friend Faith, a writer, why she has written about their other friends but never about her. You let them in all the time. It's really strange. Why have you left me out of everybody's life? Faith doesn't have a good answer and asks to be forgiven. Faith writes, "Forgive you?" Cassie laughed. With her hand, she turned my face to her so my eyes would look into her eyes. "You are my friend. I know that, Faith, but I promise you, I won't forgive you," she said. "From now on, I'll watch you like a hawk. I do not forgive you." That final line, which is also the last line of Paley's collected stories, strikes me as brutally honest and true. When I have trouble forgiving a friend, my husband says it's because I go all in. I pour everything into a new friendship, the honeymoon period, the getting to know each other. I have an incurable habit of sending pop-up holiday cards. I'm a big fan of digressive group chats. "Here are my deepest, most authentic feelings, friend. Please kindly tell me yours." But when that gesture is not reciprocated, when I sense the wall coming up, I'm so mad at myself for having revealed so much that I withdraw. Sometimes I ask my students to write about a time when they were blindsided or an incident that made them take stock. More often than not, they turn in stories about a friend betrayal. In one class, a student mentioned that their parents didn't have any friends. Around the table, everyone nodded. It seemed that no one's parents had friends, and my students couldn't fathom this, couldn't fathom it when I admitted, foolishly, to having fewer friends in my 30s than I'd had in my 20s. Horror, pity. I tried to defend myself. More horror, more pity. How could this happen to a person? How could a person let it happen? No, it would not happen to them. The wonder and the curse of friendship is choice. You can't choose your family, but you can choose your friends. For me, common qualities and habits help. Female, about my age, sense of humor. I would not choose a friend who went out dancing all night on ecstasy. No offense to dancing or ecstasy, but in comparison with those things, I would be a total bore. I would not choose a friend who had a second home somewhere like the Hamptons or Lake Como or Austria. Of course, it is superficially nice to be invited to garden parties or Soho lofts, but I don't want to be the lone Asian woman in that garden wearing a cotton dress and sensible shoes. My only topics of conversation being work, the grind, and not that new art gallery down the street. In other words, the supposed freedom of friend selection goes only so far, and given how deeply my choices are informed by my background, family, and upbringing, I wonder if they are choices at all. I'm the only child of immigrants who are not only children, but whose siblings and parents stayed in China. I have no cousins here, no aunts, uncles, or grandparents. As a kid, I was distressingly lonely, and, like my students, my younger self placed grave significance on having not just friends, but the ability to make them. To befriend was to assimilate and to speak English. To have a friend was to have an ally. I still fear the time when I am alone. Statistics predict that I will outlive my husband, and then what? I get through my last decade texting my friends? Having kids is a solution. I could spend the last decade texting them, or their kids, and getting wrapped up in all of that. But I don't see myself having kids. I live in a building where the parents are friends because their kids are friends. Hard to say if they would have been friends without the kids. And that makes me wonder if friendship is genuine, if the choice to stay connected and on good terms is not entirely a solo one. My husband and I have friends in our building because our dogs are friends. We have a group chat named after our dogs with this other couple, and we pet sit for one another. Our friendship is so rooted in our dogs that when we ate out together for the first time, dogless, more than a year after we'd started looking after each other's fur babies, we all felt that it was kind of weird. But then we did it again, and it wasn't so weird. I used to think that our friendship with this couple was one of convenience, but I don't think that anymore. Sometimes you have close friends because they are close by and have compatible dogs. If a friendship is meant to be a give and take, an ideal friend should, in theory, give as much as she takes. But this then opens the door for the frustratingly fair friend. She weighs every gesture and transaction, puts every bill down to the cent. She remembers every favor, every imbalance of favors. She looks up the price of your birthday gift to her in order to give you an item of commensurate value. In Chinese, qi kui means to eat a loss. This friend will never qi kui, yet is shrewd enough never to seem like she's taking advantage. Technically, the fair friend is not in the wrong. And if I'm noticing her behavior, then I too am guilty of keeping score. But do I accept the friend who takes more than she gives? The taking is not always tangible. There's the friend who keeps forgetting her wallet, and then the friend who expects you to be there for her at whatever cost. Inconvenient as it may be for you to step out of class, mute the Zoom screen, get off the subway, this friend is having a crisis and she would like your opinion, even though it's not an opinion she'll take. She would still like you to hear and validate her crisis. I've never known a crisis friend to have just one crisis, and before you know it, you've read and replied to thousands of texts about her problems, which are all interrelated and endemic, and soon, mired in another emergency that you're coaching her through, she throws up her hands and announces, "I've had it. No one in the world cares about me. I can't rely on anyone anymore except myself." She sighs with profound feeling. You blink, balk. You think, "What the F have I been doing? What the effety F word has every conversation we've ever had been for?" Then you realize that what your friend wanted from you is a mother, and when you couldn't measure up, you too became part of the cold, unfeeling world. Inverting the dynamic completely is the friend who wants to be your mother. She demands to be relied on, to be your go-to. She remembers your birthday, your pet's birthday, your wedding anniversary, when you moved to the city, when you plan to go upstate. About that time, isn't it? She knows you. Or thinks she does. She's the first to like your photos, your tweets, the first to give you the name of a CPA, a dentist, a real estate agent, a doctor, her CPA, her dentist, her real estate agent, her doctor. And for a very long time, this feels supportive until it feels intrusive and like surveillance and not nurturing at all, but a show of control. When you seek out your mothering friend in your low moments, you feed her ego. She wants to help, but above all, she wants credit for helping you, and she relishes the flex. Whenever you ask after her well-being, she pronounces herself emphatically great. You try to poke around more. You sense that she isn't as well as she claims, and without fail, she adds, "No, really, I'm great, super. How about you? You seem stressed. Anything I can do?" How to handle such a question? Do you say, "Yes, please deliver the chicken soup," which she would gladly do, or do you feel bad for always being the broken one? I already have a mother with whom I have a complex, routinely difficult, and uniquely volatile bond that would take over this essay and any story I ever write, should I let it. I don't need another mother. So I learn to interact with these friends less. I offer up less of my life. I'm great, too, super, never better. I recognize that to question the motives behind a friend's support is both paranoid and ungrateful. But I worry that if my vulnerability fuels her vanity, then an inherent rivalry exists between us, one that I want no part of, over who is the best friend. I am certainly not the better friend. I can't remember everyone's important dates and be there for everything and like every comment within 30 seconds of his existence, and I definitely don't want to be my friend's mother. So, if I'm not the better friend, then I'm the worse friend. I'm the one who takes more than I can give. All of this is to say that friends grow apart. Commonalities change. Common habits diverge. Qualities that you didn't much like in a friend amplify, and your own traits, priorities, shift. A friendship is not stagnant, and growing together is usually not the norm. It's nice to have writer friends, but then all you talk about is writing and how insane you have to be to do it. Nice to have friends with other jobs, but then all you hear about is their work, which you might not understand or care about. Work colleagues can never be true friends, and neither can one students. A fake friend is easy to spot, and even easier is the friend or acquaintance who, after a long period of no contact, emerges from literally nowhere with the message, "Hey, just saw you published a book. Here's a picture of that book in a bookstore. Let's grab coffee and catch up." Platitudes. A true friend is someone you can be your true self with. A true friend calls you out on your BS. A true friend sticks with you through thick and thin. But is any of that really possible or fair? How well do I tolerate being called out on my BS? And how comfortable am I now at calling other people out on theirs? Can a true friend stay with you forever? Or, a better question, can a friend stay true to you forever? Is Cassie a true friend to Faith? What my students say, friendship is a gift, a sacrifice. Friendship is all about timing and who you are at that moment and what you need. My students are always living for the moment, and they have strong opinions about what it means to be a good, true friend. When I was in college, my friend circle was wide and healthy. Thanks to clubs, class, lab, and Harvard's housing system, the blocking group, wherein at the end of freshman year you chose up to 7 people you were close to, your blockmates, and are then sorted into a house with them and live with them for the next 3 years. To entangle matters even more, your blocking group can link with another group to sort into the same house, and those in the latter group become your link mates. Should you not have a group and have to sort on your own, you're called a floater. These terms were fun to use at the time, but are now glaring reminders of how successful my alma mater is at institutionalized friendship. Institutionalized to then build a strong alumni network which donates large sums back to the nest where the camaraderie began. By the end of senior year, my blocking group, a collection of misfits, had toppled. There was so much politics in my lab, given the constant pressure to publish, and my friends in clubs were already moving on to bigger, better things like med school, law school, or jobs in the real world. I don't think my experience was unique. You have friends for the period that you have them for, and that period ends. I know that a friendship has cooled when I find myself asking, would we be friends if we met today? I used to think cooled meant over. In the words of the pop icon my students are obsessed with, we are never, ever getting back together. But cooled does not necessarily mean severed. Though friends are not family and are not obligated to stay with me, they have accompanied me for part of the journey, and for that I owe them. I owe us the chance at some future point to fortify the bond again. A final anecdote. The building that I live in houses both faculty and students. Often I smell weed in the stairwells. Every weekend of the school year, students, never dressed for the weather, are just leaving to go out as my husband and I are coming back in. Sometimes I can't even move through the lobby because when there's a party in the building, every student is trying to sign in 3 others. Faculty and students share the common spaces, the laundry room, the elevators. It is very awkward to bump into familiar students while you are removing your underwear from the dryer or while they are removing theirs. A terrible arrangement, I tell people, mixing students and teachers. But here is something that happened the other day while I was writing this essay. From the lobby, I entered the elevator with my dog. A pair of summer students came in, too, with their suitcases and totes, and my dog and I were pushed into a corner. I was annoyed that summer students were already moving in less than 2 weeks after the regular ones had left. I imagined more weed, more parties, full washers and dryers, rank trash drips in the hallways for workers to clean up. Then the two students started talking about their afternoon plans. Today they were going to go to Central Park, sit on a blanket, make friendship bracelets, and braid each other's hair. They were earnest. I heard no sarcasm. An interloper to this casual, wholesome moment, I was reminded that, though most friendships are temporary, they are very beautiful in bloom. The friends left the elevator, laughing, tote bag to tote bag. All my annoyance went away. And now a poem from the August 5th, 2024 issue of the New Yorker. This is a test of the Federal Emergency Management Agency Wireless Warning System by Dobby Gibson. We've all walked into the bar of a joke we'll never get. Knock, knock from the evangelicals inviting you to pancakes. Knock, knock from democracy looking for its key fob. Don't open the door if the knob feels warm. When all goes quiet, you'll know the wolves have you right where they want you. Some days, more than anything, I want my old bike back. Some nights I switch on the porch light to watch the bugs. It's nice to have something bright and buzzing to gather around. Hasn't the goal all along been to make an unforgettable sound? For Beethoven, the ringing in his ears never stopped. For Miles, there was no wrong note, only what comes next. And it's hard not to fear what comes next. One summer, the emergency is the butterflies vanish. The next is nothing but smoke. What's really scary are miniature horses, pink ribbons in their tails, prancing around the fair while everyone conceals and carries and cotton candy fills the air. A fortune lurks at the center of every grapefruit. There's a howl coming from inside the glacier. An old car backfires. Then the sky is full of crows. We've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Again, that's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.